From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I am honored to have sitting across from me a man who has found, I think, something funny and dramatic in bringing trauma into his movie scripts, from Analyze This to, well, to his newest film, of course, is Manchester by the Sea. Of course, we also know him from Margaret, and You Can Count on Me, the writer-director, Kenneth Lonergan, who we also know from his stage work as well. First of all, Kenny, pleasure to have you here. Thank you.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
But also, tell me, you know, for you, I mean, because that idea of, like, and I mentioned this to you when we saw each other a few nights ago, family is destiny, is really kind of almost a through line in your work.
I guess I don't, you know, it's hard for me. I don't want to be contradictory, but I don't think,
yes,
I just
do.
Don't think.
I do, oh,
man.
Now you, now
oh, man, I want to be so
now
contradictory.
Now you're going to apologize for, I don't want to be contradictory?
No, I'm going
to
just retract it. I don't think in those terms. I don't think when I'm starting out in big sweeping terms like family is destiny. I don't mind people. I actually admire people who can and do function in those at that macro level. But I'm more thinking about, there's a guy in Manchester. There's a guy in Quincy, Massachusetts, who's a janitor, and he acts very strangely, and he's cut off from people, and he doesn't relate to them normally. And what's up with him? And then moving forward, specific by specific, and I might have an overview in mind, but I try to keep it as much in the background of my own consciousness as possible when I'm working, because it doesn't help me all that much.
You know, think about family, because family's been involved in almost everything. We go back to This Is Your Youth, or Waverly Gallery, or Lobby Hero. Those are, the family's kind of key to all those pieces.
That's
too.
Absolutely true, but I never think of it that way. I never think like family with a capital F. I'm just thinking about This Is Our Youth. I'm thinking about three kids in 1982 on the Upper West Side and in a room and a lobby here. I'm thinking about the security guards in the lobby and the police officers. And then Waverly Gallery, I was thinking about my family and my grandmother and myself and my mom and that in my grandmother's declining years. But I don't think in terms of the topic of family ever. I will say this, that most people that you meet, you know, have a family, and their family is a big part of who they are. And once you get to know people, you start to learn about their, you know, they will talk about their friends and their family. And it obviously is a tremendous foundation of who people are. And if you don't have one, that's a big part of who you are as well. So to me, it just goes along with being a human being. And it's also the place where you have the strongest relationships sometimes, and the most complicated relationships, and that's just fodder for drama or comedy, depending.
But it's almost, for me, the difference between the stage versus movies, whereas so many plays are about family and families, and I just wonder if it becomes part of the intimacy of the theater, where it's become something that's easier to render, and because movies want to be about much grander things, that they tend to shy away from it a little bit. And we often meet movie characters and we don't know anything about their families, but the families are really important for you. And I just, as I was thinking about this, to ask you if that maybe comes from the fact that you started off in theater where family is so important.
I really don't know, because it's not something I'm thinking, I mean.
But you've seen a lot of plays where that's
absolutely.
Well, that's the plot or the theme.
But yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Like Shakespeare's plays are all about families, even if they're royal families, you know, or all the history plays are all, you know, the Lancasters and the Yorks and the King Henry IV and Henry V and all those plays, they're all about families. But they're also about politics and being the king and revolutions and ambition and all the millions of things that Shakespeare writes about. You know, it is true, like Humphrey Bogart movies, you very rarely hear a reference to a family member. Humphrey Bogart never seems to have any relatives whatsoever. And Cagney, too. Occasionally, one of them will have a brother or something. Humphrey Bogart has and George Brent are brothers in They Drive by Night. And Cagney has
George
a
Raft.
George Raft, excuse me, thank you. What did I say?
George Brent.
Why did I say that? No, I meant to say George. I think I just muttered. I know it's George Raft. I wasn't born yesterday.
Of course you do. Of course you do. When a Cagney character has a family member, it's white heat, so it could be the thing that drives him crazy.
That's
it's
right.
The thing that sort of winds him up.
And he has a brother, too, in The Crowd Roars, which is a race car movie. But usually they're grown-ups without family attachments. They're usually not even married, those guys. So that is a different kind of a movie, a different kind of a story. But I really don't think that much about whether it's a family story or not.
I guess I wonder, too, if at some point it becomes a little the way you bring your own family in, because you talked about that with Waverly Gallery. If you find that you'd end up using your own family as basically the protein that kind of informs the bodies of these plays.
Well, that play was a little different because that's the only thing I've ever written that the entire thing was autobiographical from start to finish. There's been autobiographical elements, direct autobiographical elements in a lot of what I've written. The high school in Margaret, for instance, is the high school that I went to, updated to 2005. And a lot of the scenes in the classroom from that movie are verbatim from scenes that I remember from high school. And the characters in that film are very much Upper West Siders, as I am. And but Waverly Gallery is my family, and I'm a character in the story, and it's my grandmother and my mom and stepfather. And that was different because that was just this, you know, my grandmother had severe dementia and was never diagnosed as Alzheimer's or not, but the end of her life was just absolutely terrible. And there was it was relentlessly terrible, and it seemed like this immense thing that had happened. And I didn't really know what to do with it, and I wanted to write about it. And in the end, the narrator of the play doesn't know what to do with it either, except chronicle it. But it is a play. It's somehow fictionalized because it's a play, because you have to make you have to select events to make a story and to make a shape, and just by doing that, you're editorializing and your mind is your interest is you're following your interest in selecting certain aspects of this enormous thing that happened. But that's the only time I've ever used my own experience that directly. This Is Our Youth is akin to that, but I'm not in that. That's my friends and I'm woven into their personalities, but it's composites of myself and my friends at the time in 1982 when we were all smoking pot and wasting our time in the Upper West Side at the onset of Reaganism.
It's a treatment. I'm being contradicted by my guest, Kenny Lonergan.
So politely and courteously.
That's what I was thinking. I was sitting here sweating like I've been shot in the leg. Whose newest film as writer-director is Manchester by the Sea, which had an incredible premiere at the Sundance Film Festival this year. And one of the things I was mentioning to you when I saw you, we had an event at LACMA the other night, a couple nights ago, but when I met you a few years back at LACMA when we so graciously came with Margaret, is that idea of just awkwardness being prevalent in the work. I mean, that idea of one person, and it's really, we talked about it a lot, we should talk about it here, how that awkwardness of the Casey Affleck character who's dealing with the aftermath of a couple of traumas and not being able to talk about them, how characters find a way to sort of bring everybody into whatever state it is they're experiencing.
I think that, you know, awkwardness crops up everywhere you go in some way. You walk in a room full of strangers, and unless you're just a really experienced socializing type or a politician who's a professional get-to-know-you person, and there's always a certain amount of social awkwardness in varying degrees. And I think it's interesting to exploit for dramatic purposes and just interesting to look at from a human perspective. And because it's the presence of conflict, it may be on a very small scale or a minute scale, but it's there, and conflict is pretty generally acknowledged to be at the heart of all drama and most comedy. And so I find life to be very awkward, so possibly I'm just drawn to those situations.
The character that Casey Affleck plays in the film, Lee, is somebody who his awkwardness becomes almost a social force in this. And what I observed and mentioned to you recently about is he almost uses awkwardness as a way to level the playing field. Yeah. So he ends up making everybody else feel the way that he does.
Yeah. No, that's true. And this is a very specific approach he has to his interactions, because this is someone who's been well and truly devastated by life and by what's happened to him and by what he's lost. And he is someone who would prefer not to have any interactions at all. He's much more comfortable being on his own, not having to talk to people, not being affected by people. That's impossible to do if you're, you know, unless you're a complete hermit of some kind. But so he creates this method of keeping people at a distance. He likes to do jobs. He likes to do tasks. He likes to keep busy because he doesn't want to be alone with his thoughts, but he doesn't want anyone else intruding on his thoughts either. So that's a very hard row to hoe, and it makes him seem very strange because he doesn't, you know, Casey and I discussed this a lot, and Casey in his performance embodies this with infinite variety. Someone will say something to him and he doesn't just react. He thinks about how he's going to react and how much he's going to react. And then he gives it, and then he gives them his answer. And then he waits for them to speak again. That's a very strange affect, at least, even though Casey and I, by the time we got through, pretty well understood the intention and the reason for it. But he's not uncomfortable saying nothing. He'll answer your question and wait for the answer, and people are very thrown by that. And because you're right, he's trying to keep people at a distance. And what happens in the story is that he's unable to do that when he gets into contact with people who are closer to him, like his nephew, who's played by Lucas Hedges. And that throws him off, and he's forced to engage pretty much against his will. And ultimately, I find it, you know, to be very touching because this guy's just been hurt so badly. He just does not want to be in the mix anymore. But his sense of duty and his sense of obligation towards his nephew and his brother make it impossible for him to stay outside the sphere of human interaction.
Yeah, I just think the idea of manufacturing circumstances under which you have to be social, but you're incapable of doing it. And so you go to your default, which is to turn every social transaction is something that makes you feel like you're doing what you can do, but makes the other person feel worse, which only exacerbates that misery that you're feeling.
I guess so, yeah. But I think it's funny because you can see Casey is one of the great things about what he does is I think it would be pretty boring to watch him be totally closed off, but you can kind of see him deciding how much he's going to engage with people as he goes. And there are certain people he's very comfortable just talking about the drain or the toilet, clogged up toilet. And early on in the film, there's a girl who's a tenant played by Quincy Bernstein, who's this great actress. And she really likes him. And he overhears her talking about him when he's fixing her toilet. And he clearly likes her too. And there's this long pause as he's saying goodbye to her and going off to his next job, where, you know, which we discussed, and you can see he kind of wants to ask her out, but he's just not going to. And he's much friendlier to her than to some of the other people he talks to.
To everybody else.
To everybody else. But he chooses not to, and he goes away. And then he's back with another tenant with whom he's comfortable being at a complete distance. So I think this, you know, this has been going on now in the story for 5 years. So it gets lonely if you don't talk to anybody. And I don't think he's comfortable anywhere, really, this character. And it's so nice to see Casey's, the differences in the way he behaves with different characters.
We're going to take a break now. My guest, Kenny Lonergan, has finally agreed with me. His new work as writer-director is Manchester by the Sea. It's a treatment there's
just
more.
Just trying to bring out the best in you, man.
And you make me work for it, too. This is public radio. It's a treatment there's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
The treatment, my guest who's playing with his shirt rather than make eye contact
with me.
I
thought there was a little tag that, you know, that rubs against your skin. You can strip it off.
It's
a label.
That's just a label, so you know.
I wasn't avoiding you.
No, it doesn't look like it.
I was just taking care of my own comfort first.
You know, that's why you're here. But we're going to make that easier for you by talking about your new film as writer-director, Manchester by the Sea. And you said something which I was kind of shocked by, which is that people think Casey's character is closed off. And you mentioned this to me a few nights ago, and I was shocked by that just because I thought, I can't think of another case when somebody's trying so hard to force himself to behave differently but doesn't have the equipment to do so and hasn't for a long time.
Yeah. No, that's true. And I think I don't mean to be argumentative. I think I might have said I think I might have said shut down.
Forgive my imprecision.
That's okay. But I think he is trying to close himself off, but as you pointed out, very sagely, he's still putting himself in situations where he's with other people. So he obviously doesn't want to be completely closed off. But I think the term that I found to be understandable, but I don't quite agree with it, is shut down, because this is a guy who's in agony and doing everything he can very actively to fend it off and to ward it off or to keep it at bay. And he's in emotional agony, I mean, and he's, you know, the distress that he's trying to keep from crushing him is very real and very serious. And so it's a real job of work to keep it at bay every single day and evening of his life. But I don't mind if people describe it in different ways. It's just words. I think the performance and the character are coming across the way, in a way that's very satisfying and feels like we did our job the way we wanted to.
I guess one of the things I was thinking is that what I like about this movie and Margaret is that you really giving yourself time to live with the pauses and the silences that people have when they're left with their own thoughts and don't know what to do with themselves physically. And that's for me a big jump from You Can Count on Me to Margaret and then to Manchester by the Sea, to allow these characters just that space and to let us as an audience stew in that awkwardness. I'm not going to say like discomfort and misery, because it's not always the case, although it is the case sometimes.
Yeah.
But just that kind of tension that creates, it becomes like another way of informing character, doesn't it?
It is, and it's also really interesting when you keep the camera rolling and you don't cut, and you keep the scene going and you don't cut away from it. What I hope happens is that you're drawn into it a little bit more. And this is something I approached on two fronts. One, I don't really love to think of the work I do in relation to other work, because that seems to me a bit literary and a bit intellectual.
How do you mean?
I mean, I wouldn't make a choice in the movie because it's different from some other movie that I've seen. You know what I mean? I wouldn't write a scene in a certain way because it's a new way to write a scene for its own sake. I would write it if it came out, if the scene turned out to be different from any other scene that's ever been written or different from most movies, then it would be because I was interested in it in its own value, not in relation to life, not in relation to other cinema, in as much as it's possible for me to separate the two. So I don't have, for instance, a non-traditional ending because I want to be non-traditional. I have the ending that I think is right for the material, and I don't care if it's traditional or not. I'm just not interested in that particular conversation with the work. Let me rephrase that. I'm not interested in that particular conversation through the work. It's an interesting conversation to have, but when I'm trying to build a story, I'm just trying to build a story. That said, I do think there's something interesting that happens when we're all so familiar with the vocabulary of film now, of movies and television. We all know when the cut is going to come. You know what the normal rhythm of a movie is these days, just like you would know what the normal rhythm of a movie was in the 30s, which is quite different. In the 30s or 40s, they always did a crossfade or a fade out between scenes. They never cut from one location to another, almost never. It's always a dissolve, and you get very used to that very quickly. Nowadays, everyone's very familiar with the hard cut and the comedy cut.
Because we don't have to be told about the passage of time the same way anymore.
Yeah, we just think about it. It's just a common vocabulary that's built up. And an interesting thing happens when you break that, is that there's a moment of where I think you get a little disoriented, because you're like, the scene should be over by now, because normally you would just cut away from it at this point. There's the joke, and you cut on the joke or whatever. You know, you go in as late as possible and you get out as early as possible is the famous dictum about editing and about screenwriting. But when you stay in the room, I notice that this thing happens where you start to you may feel even a little bored for a few minutes or a few seconds, but then you start to re-enter the scene as if it's really happening, which I almost stumbled on that by accident with Margaret.
I was going to ask you if that was something that was on the pages you find as you were cutting and shooting.
Both, because Margaret was the original script was written somewhat experimentally, in that I didn't. This is not what we shot, but the first draft of the script was 378 pages long. And immensely fun to write, because I just decided as an experiment to not do any editing while I was writing it and not to cut the scenes down. I had scenes that went on for 16, 17 pages, and just to keep the written script out of any relationship with what would be a shooting script, and to see what would happen. And all sorts of I've never had more fun writing anything in my life, because I knew what the structure of the story was. I knew where the story was going, and I just switched my brain off and wrote almost as if with my eyes closed, you know, so to speak. And all these really interesting scenes and dialogue and characters came in. There's 50 speaking roles in that movie, and they're all pretty much real parts. And it was very easy to chop 200 pages out of that and get it down to a long movie rather than a, you know, marathon, you know, rather than an 8-hour marathon. It's a 3-hour movie. But one thing that happened was that in the editing, we found that when you cut the scenes at the normal place, the movie just died, because the whole movie depended on this unusual rhythm of telling the story. And I found myself watching these screenings and really being drawn into the, you know, first you wait for the scene should be over. You're a little bit wondering why the scene isn't over. And then it goes on and on and on. And you're suddenly watching it as though you're watching a real conversation. Because I don't know about you, but I often find in life I wish that someone would cut, you know, and get me out of the room and get me to my next destination. Or especially when something bad is happening, you're just like, man, I want to be at home in bed now, and I don't want to live through the next 8 hours before I get there. But that doesn't happen. You're in this fucking room, and you're just like, God, get me out of here. And that's a really dramatic, tense situation. And so when you leave the camera on and you let the scene roll out, people, you know, you get a lot of you get a great yield from that. At least I feel like you do.
Well, my feelings aren't hurt, but I guess
I don't mean this room. Oh, I don't mean this room. This is fun. I'm talking about like when you're in a hospital or you're at the lawyer's office, you're getting some bad news, or your dog is sick and throwing up in the, you know, or anything, or just when you're at a party and you want to leave and you can't because you'd hurt somebody's feelings, or just, you know, it could be a big reason or a little reason, or just
which brings me back to the reason I talked about awkwardness so much, is not just that character, but I think it's something that I think as kind of subtextual defines what you are as a writer.
Sure, but I mean, there's no, and you don't have anything if you don't have subtext. You've got a lot of chatter.
Have you been to the movies?
Yeah, and the ones that have no subtext, you can't watch. They're unwatchable. You can't have people talking about how they feel every second. It's revolting, and it's an insult to people's intelligence. And nobody talks like that or acts like that or feels like that.
My guest, who just became a film critic, is Kenneth Lonergan. His newest film as writer-director is Manchester by the Sea. It's The Treatment.
If I were a film critic, I would name names. I'm talking about a general trend.
This is more fun I've had in doing this show in a long time.
Thank you.
No, thank you.
Me too.
But I think that just it becomes a way of, and it's not just one way, it's not just a character, but it's also about playing out a moment or maybe making a moment go by too fast. You've done that sometimes too, where there is a cut on what we expect there to be another moment, because even with You Can Count on Me, there's a lot of breathing room in it. And I'm just wondering if you found as a director that you were surprised at what that allows you to do directing film, because it's one thing to say it's a different medium in the abstract, but to see it play out in front of you and to see how you can use silence as a way to sort of take audiences in places they don't have expectations about, that must have been thrilling for you.
It is really thrilling, and but only if the silences are filled with something. You know, there's a beautiful moment, and I'm not being immodest because it's not my moment, it's Michelle Williams' moment in this film, where she's about to, there's a scene toward the end of the movie between her and Casey Affleck, and they haven't spoken for a long time, and they were married earlier in the story, and she wants to talk to him, and they haven't talked for a while, and she's takes this incredibly long pause before she starts talking, and she actually turns her face away from the camera and looks at the wall. And you almost start crying just watching her, because you can see she's so full emotionally that she can't – she's just trying to calm down before she opens her mouth, because she doesn't trust herself to speak without losing it. And it's really beautiful, but it's as full as any dialogue-laden scene could possibly be, or fuller. And you don't just have silences to have them. You have them because they're dramatic, or they're funny, and they're charged. And that's just an example in the performance where you'd be mad to cut away from that just to move the scene along.
There's also a moment too, and I mentioned this to you, where Casey is laying in bed after having had an awkward conversation with his ex, and he's just laying there, and we know he's not going to go to sleep.
Yeah.
And that's a long beat of him just laying in his bed.
Yeah, I'm glad you like that. I like it too, and I wouldn't, but neither of us would like it if it wasn't a full moment, if it wasn't emotionally charged. And I think I just, you know, I don't think there's a tremendous difference between silence and talking. I think that they're both driven by your emotional life and by what's happening in the room.
But this takes me too to something I mentioned to you, and I'm glad to get a chance to talk about it here, which is that way that you use characters repeating a question. And it's really – it fascinates me because it's that thing that happens in life where you realize you ask somebody, well, how are you? And you realize when you're doing it, it's almost like a tick, which is this thing we've been conditioned to do, and you're not really hearing it.
Yeah.
And it happens in this really great moment in the film, but it's happened in your stage work as well, and This Is Our Youth, where a line gets repeated, a question gets repeated, and what happens is it's almost a way of breaking somebody down.
It is in a way, or it can be. I think also people reset. You know, I was thinking about this because we were talking about this the other night, as you say, it's a way of resetting the conversation, because when you're talking to someone, you're kind of drifting in and out of connection with them. You can be there talking and you're either listening closely or your mind might be drifting, or between the two of you, nothing's getting any traction. And so someone might just reset by saying, so what's up, or what's going on, or so what are we doing, or how are you, or any of these little starter comments that might redirect the conversation to a more productive avenue.
Because what happens, though, in these situations that you've written is that it's a way that the characters get tested, but it's also both kind of funny and awkward at the same time, because it's so real. It's this thing that whenever I see it, I sort of bite my little lip. I think, how many times have I done that? Ask somebody, how are you, not realizing that I'm not listening to them or they're not listening to the question. And there, you put so much in these, there's so much at stake in these conversations that feel like they are repetitive, but in fact, there's something that's not being said, not being answered.
Yeah, even if you're using the same words, you're at a different phase in the interaction. And the scene, you know, one of the main things that doesn't work in scenes that don't work is the fact that it's a repeated emotional beat, which apparently never really occurs in life. You can repeat yourself. You can start over. But if I ask my roommate or my wife, which I never would do, when she's going to pick up the shoes and put them in the closet, or my daughter, it's very different the fifth time you ask from the first time, from the second time, from the third time, even if you use the same words. That's a very small example, but there, you know, it ranges all over the place. It's just interesting the way people talk to each other and how with each other they are or aren't, and even if they're trying to be with each other, how they find a place that's comfortable for them to be together in the same conversation. It's often very hard to get to.
I wish I had more time to fight with you, but we're out of time. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I don't consider it to be a fight at all. I think it's a very productive exchange.
That's how you make pearls and diamonds, I guess. My guest, of course, is Kenneth Lonergan. His terrific new film as writer-director is Manchester by the Sea. And again, thanks for doing this, Ken.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure.
Recording engineer here at KCRW is Kat Yor, who also mixes the show. It's edited by Blake Byte, who's associate producer. I'm just fighting my way to the bell. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.